Our next speaker is going to give us a governmental perspective on the planning process, and it's John Weber from the Massachusetts Office of Coastal Zone Management. And in that office, John manages the development of the Ocean Management Plan, which was published in January of this year. Previously at the Coastal Zone Management Office, John's work included a review of Boston waterfront development and planning activities. Before that, he worked on restoration projects in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Thank you, Dave. I'm going to do something I've never done before giving a presentation. I'm going to take off my sweater. Don't worry, I'm not going further than that. I first of all want to say thank you to Rick and Kim. You guys, those are great presentations, and we all really need to reflect on a lot of what you're saying. What I'm going to be talking about is, in part, going to be how we in Massachusetts took to heart some of the things that you were saying, recognizing at the start of our ocean management planning effort that somebody much smarter than I said, you know, it's interesting that you guys are doing that, but what you're talking about is really 75% all about going out and talking to people. It's about 25% all the other stuff that goes into it. I think actually that's fairly well true. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time today talking about some of the other 25%, but that does not at all reflect what I actually think is the most important part of what we did, and that is advancing the conversation through meetings like this. Why are we doing what we are doing? What are those policy goals that we're really after? What are those things that we have to work out? Because we're talking about some stuff, some new territory for all of us. Before I get started, Representative Fitz earlier this morning said that, I think a very smart thing. He said, you know, we're working in the policy arena here, and sometimes that involves arm waving, maybe a little bit of anger. In Massachusetts, we also add to that rudeness. So I fully agree with what you said. These are tough issues, and we should not kid ourselves about that. At the same time, we shouldn't shy away from that, because these are important issues. Somebody else today brought up their kids, and their grandparents, their grandchildren, something like that. We're not kidding around with some of this stuff. That is the level of some of this that we're trying to get after. If you come at it from an energy security standpoint, from a climate change standpoint, from a we need to get out of this nasty, horrible recession standpoint, these are the types of things we're talking about. What we are doing here has ramifications, so I want to say something about that. Really what I'm going to do for the rest of my talk is I'm going to talk about kind of a little bit of the how we got to some of the things we did, but I really want to talk about the process that we used to figure out where should we put wind energy projects offshore. Brief background. Why did we do this? There's gathering momentum in the early 2000s in Massachusetts, and we were part of this decade. A project that, you know, rhymes with Snape Mind down in Nantucket Sound was a big part of that. I'm not really allowed to talk about a particular project that's still being litigated. We had other offshore developments that were generally in the energy arena. Those were also popping up, some liquid natural gas ports offshore of Boston. When the Patrick administration, our current Governor Patrick, came in, he set in place a sort of multi-pronged effort to address climate change. This is a very big deal to him. It included things like additional conservation, efficiency measures, but it also included a really serious hard look at development of renewable energy. And obviously in the Northeast, a lot of that is wind. All of that led to what was passed in 2008 was the Massachusetts Ocean Act. It's a piece of legislation that tells us to do a bunch of things. From our perspective, the legislature kind of threw in some pieces of that were sort of equal parts cattle prod, and equal parts giving us a place to hide. Legislature said, you guys, state government, you have essentially a year to come up with a draft plan for management of the Commonwealth's human uses and natural resources. Particularly, the legislature said, pay attention to renewable energy and figure out places where it makes sense to do that. This is, however, a plan before a permit. So this is not meant to be a permitting process. It's rather, we didn't like how some of those previous offshore developments came about. Sort of there was a general sense that a developer had staked out their part of the water. Everybody sort of threw themselves against that wall, and maybe we can do a better job. So let's do some planning work. So this is, again, a plan before a permit. I'm gonna, Oceans Act did a bunch of things. It really told us to be comprehensive. It told us to identify areas to protect in terms of natural resources. It told us to think about other types of ocean development other than just renewable energy. The plan does that. I'm not really gonna talk about that anymore if folks are interested in some of those other aspects. So there was a mention of one this morning from George about how we deal with cables, that sort of thing. Plan goes into a lot of detail about that. What I am going to talk about is specifically how we dealt with renewable energy facility siting. These are just some of the other things that the Oceans Act told us to do. My point with this slide is to say that in a year, that's not a long time to go from Oceans Act to essentially having a draft plan out on the street. We had to come up with a framework, something that made sense. How do you translate statute, language in the statute, which tells us to do a whole bunch of things, into something that then takes things to the next level? We had to go through a series of developing goals and strategies. This compatibility assessment and screening criteria thing, that basically is what I'm going to walk through, and all that really says is we spent a lot of time thinking about the data that we had available to work with, and thinking about what does that data tell us about how it makes sense and where it makes sense to think about siting a renewable energy project. That led directly to development of the plan and ultimately a draft plan. And a final plan. We issued a final plan a year ago. I'm going to skip over all the process stuff and go right into sort of how we approached wind power. Somebody earlier today said that in the mass plan there's a cap on the amount of turbines. That's true. It's a little more complicated than that, of course, because we're Massachusetts and can't make things simple. The commercial scale wind was defined as anything that's as a specific project that's more than 10 turbines. That's what I'm really going to focus on. So that was really meant to be those projects that even at a order of magnitude greater than that, that's when you start talking about commercial scale, economies of scale matter. The cap really applies to, the Ocean Plan also talks about, if you have a project that is less than 10 turbines. He called that community scale wind. Believe it or not, there was some interest in that even in an offshore environment, and the Ocean Plan dealt with that separately, and that's where the cap comes into play. I'm going to talk about commercial scale. So what we did was, as I said, we spent a good 6 months, 9 months, gathering all the data that we possibly could. And then we started thinking about that data, and we started thinking about a big wind project by itself. What is a big wind project on order of a commercial scale? What is it likely to impact in terms of human uses, fishing, commerce, shipping, other things? And also in terms of natural resources. Can we identify places using existing data where from a natural resource standpoint, it just doesn't make sense because we're going to have an impact to particularly, say, birds, possibly bats. We also have some endangered whale species, et cetera, that it would not make sense to do that because the impact would be too heavy. So we were looking for, we got to do some balancing here. That's what this term exclusionary criteria means. So what I'm going to step through is a series of maps that show different exclusionary criteria. And I'm actually going to build those up so you can see the progression of starting from essentially, it's all white. This white area that's outlined in red is our planning area. That red line is the extent of state waters. As we start building in blue, you're going to see here are areas where we have said, nope, it doesn't make sense, and here's why. The first one that we said is, we're talking about big projects it doesn't make sense to be within a mile of shore. Variety of reasons. Aesthetics, in part, a concentration of human uses, particularly within a mile of shore. So that was our first criteria. Our second criteria had to do with navigation. This big round blob right there is a precautionary slash anchored slash pilot boarding area offshore Boston. These are the travel lanes coming in and out of Boston. These are designated channels heading through Cape Cod Bay, Goose Buzzards Bay. So we could map those. And we said, well, it to us doesn't really make sense to, in a navigation area or shipping lane or something like that, doesn't make sense to have a commercial scale wind facility. There were some natural resources that we identified, particularly eelgrass or mudflat areas. Eelgrass is a very important habitat for us in Massachusetts, nursery for a lot of fish species that are commercially viable. Also, it sort of was a sort of no-brainer because it would be very difficult. Eelgrass is usually in fairly shallow water, particularly south of Cape Cod, and mudflats are as well. It's a very difficult construction environment. So we took those off the map, and those basically show up a little area outside Welby Harbor, some other areas, particularly on the south part of the Cape, where that shows up. Ferry routes, again, obvious reasons. Don't want to interfere with that important human use, particularly heading out to the islands of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. Birds. So this is a lot to go through. And all I'll say about this is the way that we approached birds was we took a look at existing bird data that we had. We looked at species that occur in mass waters that are, there's a particularly concern over a population level of impact. So in other words, there is some species of birds, particularly say roseate terns, that there's a very high number of the North Atlantic population that we find in mass waters. We can identify where those nesting and feeding areas are based on existing literature, and let's avoid those areas. The risk to that species is too high. So that included roseate terns, other tern species, Arctic least in common. There's a species of long-tailed duck which shows up in Nantucket Sound and then does a strange every day, flies over the island, goes down to Nantucket Shoals to feed, and a couple of other species. You can see that by taking those areas off the map, that eliminates quite a big area of Buzzards Bay and the area around Nantucket. I've already spoken to this. We could map core areas for particular marine mammal species. This includes North Atlantic right whales. There's only a couple hundred left in the North Atlantic. They congregate in Cape Cod Bay in the winter to feed. We're not exactly sure what the interaction between wind turbines and right whales could be, but they're so few number, let's be really cautious with those and avoid that area. Now we get into some of the stuff that we've been hearing about just now on the panel and talking about this morning. Our state marine fisheries agency was able to identify statewide and rank areas of fishing activity based on effort and landing. Once you add those really important areas, such as the area around Cape Ann, some areas around the vineyard, south part of the Cape, you start moving more area. In addition to the navigation pattern that comes from charts, there is an automated information system hosted by the Coast Guard, which actually tells you where vessels of a certain size go. That's nice to have because that tells you where human activity actually happens. So we were able to add that onto a layer and make some decisions about where should we avoid impacts or sort of what concentration of use should we avoid impacts based on that AIS data. We also similarly took a look at vessel monitoring system data. Even though that's an incomplete data set for fishing, it does provide you some indication of where for particular species fishermen are traversing. And the idea there was it's important to know not just where fishermen go to fish, but as you can see out this area coming out of the Port of Gloucester heading out to Stellwagen Bank, this is used as sort of a highway in the sea by a lot of fishermen. We wanted to know that. Let's not get in their way, not just in terms of where they fish, but also how they get to their fishing grounds. And then finally, regulated airspace, which in our planning area, it didn't appear to be a really big deal. There's a couple airports out on the islands where that matters. So this map then brought us to, okay, so any place that's kind of left in white is where it's possible. There's not a lot left. But we wanted to look at the other side of the coin too, which was, if you're a commercial wind project based on current technology, things that we've been hearing about today, based on things like the wind as a resource, where would you possibly want to go? So we wanted to take a look at that side of the coin too, match it up with this map and see what we had left. So here's a map of wind resource in Massachusetts. And the bottom line is that the darker the green, the better the resource. It's generally really pretty good. There's a slight wind shadow effect way up on the North Shore. So this is off Newburyport, Ipswich area, where there's a bit of a wind shadow. In Cape Cod Bay as well. Other than that, a pretty good resource, economically viable. And then we wanted to look at water depth. Water depth for us, we sort of had a cutoff of about 30 meters in water depth. That was again because we were not thinking about floating technology like folks are thinking about up in Maine. We were thinking about current sort of off-the-shelf type of technology. That tends to be roughly about 30 meters. There's a lot of factors that go into that parameter though, so take that with a grain of salt. When you do that, you take a look at that, there are areas off of Boston and in Cape Cod Bay that are deeper than that. That becomes a problem for us because that's in waters that are too deep for wind technology. And then finally, we did want to look at infrastructure needs as well, things like cables, operations and maintenance. I'm not really going to go into that right now other than to say we did take a look at that. When you put all of that together, you wind up with two things. You wind up with an area down, this isn't really clicker than working, right here. So off the tip of Martha's Vineyard and off of Cuttyhunk, thank you, that are designated commercial wind energy areas. They're the only areas in state waters right now where a commercial scale project would be allowed. There are provisional areas that tend to be in deeper water, right there, these little dashed lines. And the point of those areas recognizes that, again, technology is moving really fast. There could be technologies, because of the work up here or elsewhere, that make deeper water installation possible. So we wanted to reflect that. So my point is, I want to stop right here and say two things. My point is that what we had to do was put together a very logical, progressive, step-by-step, how are we going to identify those areas, work with the data that we have, talk to stakeholders that are out there. That's what I've been trying to illustrate with this set of slides. The other thing that I want to leave you with is these three bullet points. It kind of reflects a lot of what we've already heard. We're talking about new uses in an area that has traditionally been very strongly held as dear by traditional uses, not just fishing, but certainly including commercial fishing. That leads to passion on all sides, sometimes rudeness. We really needed to work through that because, as Rick, I think you very eloquently put it, and I think you're a very good speaker, by the way, we've got to get to a point where we can have that sit-down conversation about these issues if we're serious about moving forward with them. Part of that conversation from the government side, I will argue, is that because we are at a point where we have some policy goals that are colliding, renewable energy versus traditional uses such as fishing, there are going to be impacts. There will be. People will be impacted by these decisions. We need to be upfront about that. I think that one of the things we built into our ocean plan was a notion of community benefits. And the notion of community benefits, we don't have a formula for this, but it just says where you're going to have an impact, you need to address that impact to the best of your ability. And you can do that through specific attention paid to the types of impacts and then the types of benefits that can come from those impacts. We need to get to a point where we can do that. But in doing that, we have long and short-term goals that we need to pay attention to. That's a hard one because particularly on the long-term side of things, that's maybe a way of thinking that we're not all used to. I think one of the things that means is that we have to have meetings like this. We've got to have more of maybe even we were talking about before today, one-on-one type conversations, where we need to say, here's why we're doing this. Here's the long-term goal. Here's why it matters. If you care about it from a whatever standpoint, that means bringing in appropriate science, data, to the best of our understanding, but having those conversations so that we can actually get after some of these issues. Because for a lot of them, the clock is a ticking. So, thank you.